Shortwave, a PBS NewsHour podcast on foreign events that have an impact close to home. I'm NewsHour Foreign Affairs reporter-producer PJ Tobia. This week on Shortwave, New York Times reporter Carlotta Gall takes us down the trail that led to Osama bin Laden. She says that trail ends with the Pakistani government, which Gall claims has been hiding terrorists for years. But first, we're going to follow up on a Shortwave episode from a few weeks ago, where we explored the huge demand in the U.S. for ivory products.
We do have a major, major market here in the United States. Some reports have placed it as high as the second largest in the world.
That was part of my conversation from Episode 5 with Peter LaFontaine of IFAW, the International Fund for Animal Welfare. Well, it turns out that LaFontaine isn't the only person affiliated with IFAW who wanted to come on the program to talk about the illegal ivory trade. As you probably know, the guy playing that riff, one of the most well-known pieces of rock music of the last 30 years, is Slash, the former lead guitarist of Guns N' Roses. Since leaving GNR in 1993, Slash has released a number of critically acclaimed solo albums, formed part of the supergroup Velvet Revolver, and basically toured the world nonstop. His travels brought him to South Africa, where he had an encounter with some elephants that changed his life.
I did sort of a private, like, safari kind of thing. And just being out with the elephants in sort of their own habitat, and just witnessing them in their herds, the family groups, and so on and so forth, it was just really sort of poignant time. You know, talking with rangers who have been doing sort of the poaching detail and giving us some really bare-bones facts about what's actually happening in real time in Africa with the elephants. It was shocking.
Shortly after that, Slash got together with Miles Kennedy, the lead singer of his current group, and they wrote a song to raise money for IFAW. It's called Beneath the Savage Sun. Take a listen.
How many killing seasons can you justify? How many dead and bleeding only for an ivory lie? Or was it for the money? Or was it for the thrill? If I could have my way, no, yours would be the blood I'd spill.
It's written from the point of view of an elephant, but it's also kind of a revenge fantasy on the part of the elephant, right? It's got lyrics like, retribution will be mine. It's almost coming from an angry place.
I mean, elephants are extremely intelligent, extremely emotional and sensitive and aware living things. I mean, but more so than people probably relate to. So you can imagine the horror of being aware that people are trying to assassinate you every single day of your life, you know? If you were an elephant and being attacked from all sides and seeing members of your family and friends being picked off, you know, I think there would be a sense of revenge and anger.
Many studies have shown that one of the top ivory products Americans purchase is instruments. As it happens, guitars, especially the kind of high-end guitars that a wealthy, famous musician might play, often have ivory parts. Things like the tuning pegs to tighten the strings, or the saddle at the bottom end of the guitar where the strings sit above the sound hole. I asked Slash about that, as his collection includes over 100 guitars.
In some of the older guitars, it's possible, some of the older original guitars, it's possible there might still be pieces of ivory, in, especially in acoustic, where in the saddle. And also, tuning pegs are, I don't think I have any that have ivory tuning pegs. The guitars that I use don't tend to use ivory, but there are some very high-end handmade guitars or like a high-end line, and like I said, especially in acoustics where there was ivory being used. But it's been a long time. I've always made sure that there wasn't any ivory in anything that I used. I never bought anything that had any ivory in it.
The day before we spoke last week, CNN reported on a rich guy from Texas who spent $350,000 for a hunting permit in Namibia. That permit allowed him to legally shoot one black rhino. Of course, Slash had heard the report. He was not pleased.
It's ridiculous, and he's an ass. People that do all that trophy hunting, I see them online all the time, are f***ing sick. I can't comprehend that.
Clearly, the thought of dead elephants makes Slash very, very angry. According to the U.S. government, the trail that led to Osama bin Laden began with a courier, a man who personally carried messages from bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, to the outside world. In the CIA's response to the Senate torture report, the agency says they tracked down that courier by torturing an al-Qaeda detainee. But last week, the investigative reporter Seymour Hersh wrote a long piece in the London Review of Books taking aim at the courier narrative. According to Hersh, it was a retired top Pakistani intelligence official who gave the CIA bin Laden's location. He wanted a piece of the $25 million bounty on the terrorist's head. Let's call this version of events the walk-in theory. Hersh challenges other aspects of the official narrative. His reporting says that the U.S. and Pakistan jointly planned the raid on bin Laden's compound, and that no firefight took place when the Navy SEALs landed, that there was no treasure trove of documents captured there, as the White House claims. As soon as Hersh's story came out, many Western journalists began picking it apart.
The firefight that took place at the bin Laden compound is just sort of incontrovertibly true. The idea that this was some kind of piece of performance art cooked up by the United States and the Pakistanis is not. There's no evidence for that. In fact, there's a lot of countervailing evidence. I saw with my own eyes the damage that this very violent raid inflicted on the compound before it was demolished.
He's saying there were no other shots fired other than the shots that killed bin Laden.
That's right. And, you know, that's just, I mean...
That's Anderson Cooper interviewing longtime national security and intelligence reporter Peter Bergen. Of course, the White House and former intelligence officials also immediately called Hersh's story preposterous. Here's White House spokesman Josh Earnest shortly after the piece was published.
The story is riddled with inaccuracies and outright falsehoods. The former deputy director of the CIA, Mike Morrell, has said that every sentence was wrong. No one here is particularly concerned about it.
Just last Wednesday, the U.S. government released the first batch of bin Laden's letters and other documents officials say were captured in the raid. Some analysts say the release was timed as a response to Cy Hersh's work. A CIA spokesman tells the New York Times the declassification process for the documents began a year ago. These arguments aside, a few decidedly mainstream journalists found that some narrow but important aspects of Hersh's reporting track with their own. Carlotta Gall is one of these reporters. She spent most of the last 12 years working for the New York Times, covering Afghanistan and Pakistan. She also wrote a book called The Wrong Enemy, about Pakistan's involvement in Afghanistan. She told me the walk-in theory, that it was a high-level Pakistani official who told the CIA about bin Laden's location, is something she'd been hearing for years.
It was only after the publication of my book that I got from a high-level source that it had been a walk-in, in other words, a Pakistani military official who had told the Americans about it.
Gall cautions that there's no way to prove this definitively, but says the walk-in theory makes sense.
You can't really chase up a story like this because presumably whoever did do it, if he was serious, he would be under witness protection or perhaps have changed his name, living very low, and so on. So very difficult to pin it down, and this is the nature of this type of reporting. But it makes a lot of sense in the grander scheme of things that this is how the Americans could be so sure to do the raid because they had inside information.
Despite the difficulty of nailing down the walk-in theory, Gall insists that the Pakistani intelligence service hid and protected bin Laden for years.
After 9/11, when he slipped across the border into Pakistan, the Pakistanis gave him sanctuary, and then they actually gave him protective custody when the drone strikes were starting to be stepped up by Americans were using the drones to attack many of the rebel leaders. That's when bin Laden was removed and put in this safe house. And I learned that it was an ISI operation, that they had a special desk manned by one man who looked after it and basically handled this prime asset, to use intelligence speak.
Gall says the Pakistanis used bin Laden as a kind of bargaining chip to direct militants to do their bidding.
They used bin Laden to influence other proxy forces that they use, insurgents that they've always been using to fight their wars in Kashmir and in Afghanistan, and to use him as a figurehead, a leader who could have influence.
She says the tactic worked. Remember that cache of letters the U.S. government released last week?
One of the messages we've seen from his letters and correspondence was that he was persuading militants not to fight the mother country of Pakistan, but to go out and fight Americans, fight forces in Afghanistan, not to hurt the mothership, as he described it.
Gall says that bin Laden wasn't so much a prisoner of the Pakistanis as a guest.
Seymour Hersh describes him as a prisoner. I describe it more as a sort of protective custody. It's with his consent, but it's also a sort of controlling protection.
Gall says that bin Laden isn't the first terrorist or insurgent that the Pakistanis have sheltered.
There was a militant leader who did cause problems immediately after 9/11. He disappeared into protective custody for about 8 years, but he was never tried. He was never brought before a court, but he went out of circulation. And this is what everyone understands is how the Pakistanis control their insurgent forces.
Pakistan is home to dozens of different criminal and Islamist groups, from the Pakistani Taliban to the Haqqani Network. Gall says that Pakistani intelligence is involved with these groups, partially as a way to maintain control over them.
They, for years, have been running militant groups, and they control them through their intelligence agencies, and they train them, and they're always covert. They're supposedly, you know, not there, or banned groups, but they clearly have this control through the intelligence agencies, and often when they go too far, their leaders are quietly removed and taken out of circulation. And everyone knows that that's what's happened, that they've been controlled and they're in some safe house, guarded for their protection, but also controlled for political reasons.
If all this is true, it brings up some troubling questions. President Obama has proposed over $1 billion in civilian and military aid to Pakistan in 2016. What do officials in Washington say?
There are some who believe that we should be great friends with Pakistan, that there should be cooperation to the hilt, and that they are best allies in the war on terror. And there are others, especially ones who've served in Afghanistan or who've seen up close, like me perhaps, how great the skullduggery is, feel that they've been dealing with a country that's been two-timing America, been taking billions of dollars of aid, and yet supporting groups that have been attacking American forces in Afghanistan and Americans in the wider world.
Gall says she doesn't buy much of what's in Cy Hirsch's latest piece, aside from the walk-in theory. But she adds that these differing opinions among U.S. policymakers and intelligence officials help explain how sources in some news reports seem to have such different facts than others.
When you go to Washington or you talk to American diplomats and officials, there's always this diverse opinion, and it colors some of the leaks that come out, and it colors some of the information that comes out, which is why we have to keep digging.
That's it for Shortwave. Shortwave is a production of PBS NewsHour, Sarah Just, executive producer. Justin Kenny is NewsHour's senior producer for foreign affairs and defense. Travis Daub is creative director. Vanessa Dennis created the graphics for Shortwave. The theme music was composed by Jeremy Gibson. Jenny Martyr and Margaret Myers edit Shortwave's online content. Natalie Boyd offered production assistance, transcripts by Aisha Jama. Special thanks for editorial oversight and inspiration to Hari Srinivasan. I'm your host and producer, PJ Tobia. I hope you'll join us next time for Shortwave.